is down, you just get me right out of the gate, right out of the horse racing gate. Good morning, everybody. I'm Roger Pasquier, and I'm sitting in for MZ today. Thank you, MZ, for letting me come back again. You need a little day off. I can agree with that every once in a while. And my goodness, what a day. I want to remind everybody out there, there is a new law that you must obey. It is the windshield wiper with your headlights on law. That's right. It started January 1st. So if you're in the rain right now, you must have your lights on. Just a little tip there for you from the Saturday morning special. We've got some great guests today. We're going to be talking about some of the hottest topics in the next 2 hours, and I hope you'll be staying with us. I'll be getting to what those two topics are in just a minute. But first, I just wanted to do a little week in review, because there has been so many things going on, and I thought it would just be a good idea to do that. And by the way, if you do want to join in on the conversation, our phone number is area code 831-479-1080. That's 479-1080. Well, last weekend, I was able to sit in Saturday for Cyril on the New World Order program on Sunday, and I had the great opportunity to talk with you a little bit about steroids. And, of course, on Thursday, we had the big steroid meeting in Washington, D.C., and I have to tell you, I was very put off by Mark McGuire, and I can only tell you this, that in my own opinion, Mark McGuire, his name should be taken off the freeway, and I think probably his record redacted and taken out of the his home run record should be taken out. I just don't, you know, he took steroids, he cheated, it looks like, and it's scary to say, but Barry Bonds, 99.9% tells me that he has cheated too. And I just don't see how we can let these records stand, because the kids coming up have to look up to these records. And we don't want to be telling them, well, there's no more steroids now, but those records are going to stay. And how does a kid look to a goal to do 73 home runs? I listened to Sammy Sosa. And Sammy's opinion, I thought, or not opinion, but his claim that he never did steroids, at least he stood up and said it. Now, if that is true, and I really have a firm belief that he is telling the truth, that probably Sammy Sosa's the one that got, the raw deal out of this whole thing. Sammy hit, 65 home runs? And, you know, it's just not fair. I just don't see it as being fair. And he's the one that's out down in third place. So I really think that we should take a very, very important look at Sammy Sosa and say, I think he's the home run record. I think we get rid of Mark McGuire, and probably we're going to have to get rid of Bonds' record. These inflated figures from the steroid thing is just, it's just not right. It's just not right. And I think really Bonds probably in his right mind should retire now. And before he even goes for the big record, you know, Babe Ruth and Hank Aaron's record, I think he should just stop. Okay, he got third place. We won't deal with it. But I don't want to have to deal with it when he goes over the 700 and whatever mark, 715 or no, is that Ruth? I can't remember the exact numbers. But anyway, I don't want to deal with that. Those guys, it was a bad idea. And I know that Mark McGuire, he was literally in tears. I know he knows what's going to happen. And it's too bad. His whole record is going to be tarnished. Now, in the other two big court cases going on, Michael Jackson and Robert Blake. Ladies and gentlemen, have you ever noticed that, I'm going to tell you right now, I think it's pretty sure that Michael Jackson's going to get off. And I'll tell you why. When prosecutors put witnesses on the stand that do more for the defense than they do for the prosecution case, it's all over. And this is exactly what has happened this last week. Michael Jackson had her maid had his maid on the stand. He didn't have her. The prosecution had her on the stand. She proceeded to tell the story about these kids. Yeah, sure. Oh, she thinks they, she saw them doing, you know, some Jesus juice. But he never saw, but she never saw them actually take it. She wasn't for sure. And then she went into this whole, rad of information about how the kids were tearing up the rooms and they were going nuts and, one stuck a knife to her back, one of the kids that was on the stand. It's a bad idea. Bad idea by the prosecution. And look at Robert Blake. He's off now too. He's free. What happened there? The prosecution put a couple of noodles on the stand. Guys that had brains that, you know, don't go very much farther than that. And that's terrible. I mean, these guys were drug users, methamphetamine. They had delusions. This is what the prosecutors put on the stand, and if you listen to any of the jurors, Robert Blake, let's face it, he's off now. So that's it. They relied on druggies to confirm testimony. It happened in the OJ case. Look at Mark Furman. So that's my feelings on the last couple of days. Terrible, you know, and then Scott Peterson, of course. He gets the death penalty. He'll be in there for what? Years and years and years. Still got 600 people to put down. We can't get to those guys because of all of the kooky Rosebud laws that were put into effect over the years for that type of thing, for specifically the death penalty. And Scott will be he's a model prisoner, but it's going to take a while before we see him go. Anyway, that's the way it looks this past week. Now, of course, the biggest story of the week, I think, right now, that is sitting in front of us is this Terri Schiavo case. You've all heard about it. She is the young lady who apparently her family is saying, yeah, they don't know necessarily whether she was really bulimic or what happened. Of course, there was a jury award of the doctor against the doctor that was against her. I guess they won $1 million back some 10 years ago or 13 years ago. She was apparently bulimic. Her husband found her in the hallway of their home in the middle of the night. She was totally gone. She had asphyxiated her brain. And now this huge outcry from both sides. One saying, let her go. It's the right thing to do. That's what she wanted, according to her husband, even though there's no absolute, record. She is not really there. The standings of her parents, who are really right, I don't know how to put it, but they're very, very big Catholics who believe in this. The family is trying to get the feeding tube put back in. It has now been taken out as of last night or yesterday afternoon, I guess around 1:30. And this is an emotional topic, and even the Congress now has gotten in the middle of it. I'm going to tell you, ladies and gentlemen, you better have your paperwork in order. You better have your paperwork in order so that somebody can take care of this, because the doctors are in a jam. The people don't want to pull the plug, but apparently now it has been done on the orders of the husband. Who's in charge? Should it be the husband? Should it be the family member? Is that who should be taking care of this situation? The parents love their daughter, but to see her in that state and to hope and wish for the change that they want, I just don't see it as possible. And the doctors say that it's not possible. And that's why today I wanted to bring on our program this morning in the first hour. We're going to talk about this right to die, right to live. Issues that are so profoundly in front of us right now, and I think are hitting us right square in the chest as baby boomers. We're all starting to realize that we're going to have to deal with this, and that we better get these things down in writing so that our loved ones don't have to say, well, this is what she said, and then I have another group say, oh, no, she didn't, she would never say that. Our guest is Dr. Karen Nichols, who is a board-certified osteopath. I'm going to let you say this because my words are a little tough right now. Osteopathic, right?
That's exactly correct, Ron.
And, doctor, you're with the University, Midwestern University, Chicago College of Osteopathic Medicine in Downers Grove, Pennsylvania. You are on the chair, or you are chair of the End of Life Committee at the American Osteopathic Association. Now, tell us what an osteopath is first, so we understand. I think you're just on the same level as an MD, right?
Yes, there are two kinds of physicians that are fully licensed for the practice of medicine and surgery in the United States, and one is an allopath or the MD, and the other is an osteopathic physician or a DO. So we all can perform surgery, deliver babies, and take care of patients.
And give drugs or do prescriptions,
yes, right,
and all
prescribed medications in all 50 states.
Okay, doctor, you've been involved in this type of a situation before. It's the toughest situation in the world. Is it a law decision or is it a family decision? I guess it's a combination of both, but you better have your paperwork. Is that right? Is that what the doctor needs to see?
Well, probably the biggest service that you can do to your listening public, Ron, is exactly what you are doing, which is to bring this to a forum so that people can discuss what they want and make their wishes known. We always hope as physicians, and I'm an internist and specialize in geriatrics, we always hope that we don't have to bring the law into something like this. But when there are disagreements, such as there are in the Terry Schiavo case, we get into that situation whether we want to or not. There are two things that come to bear here. First of all, there are legal surrogacy laws. Who can speak for you when you can't speak for yourself? And the spouse is always the person who has the next right to speak if you can't utter your own wishes, unless you have indicated that someone else should have that privilege. And that can be in the form of an advance directive like a living will, or appointing a health care proxy who takes care of you in your health care decisions when you can't. So there are protocols of who can speak. So obviously in this case, the husband is the person who has the right to say what the decisions of this patient could have been if she would have been able to answer for herself now. The reason we're in such a mess with this is that the family disagreed. So they're keeping all of this up in the air, and not that they're wrong. They have the right to challenge that statement.
Well, now there's been something like 15 or, I don't know, 18 or 19 cases brought before various jurisdictions, including, I think, the Supreme Court several times that basically say if there isn't anything there, it's the husband or the wife that has the jurisdiction over this person. Is that correct?
That is correct. However, there's not always a husband and wife in a situation. You mentioned that in this case, Terry had not given any kind of an advance directive. She didn't have a living will. She didn't designate a health care proxy.
And she was like 25 years old, you know.
Right,
she didn't think
happened.
She needed it.
But then the U.S. Supreme Court, who decided not to weigh in on this particular case, did weigh in on a similar case, and the case law referred back to a woman in Missouri named Nancy Cruzan, and she was of a similar age when she hit a patch of black ice on the road and ended up in a similar situation with exactly the same situation of having a feeding tube. And this came up to the Missouri Supreme Court, and they said that there was no clear and convincing evidence what she wanted done. That went to the U.S. Supreme Court, and they came up with that particular phrase, clear and convincing evidence, such that a person doesn't have to have anything in writing. And if they don't have a spouse, then there is no clear decision-making path of how to go in a situation. Then they can bring in a variety of people who had spoken with the patient in question over the years. And if they can provide, again, the U.S. Supreme Court's phrasing, clear and convincing evidence of what that person wanted, then that's how the decision is made. Again, there are conflicting statements in this Terry Schiavo case, so they're not meeting the standard of clear and convincing evidence because she didn't provide a lot of background discussion with a variety of people that can be referenced at this point. So we're left in this terrible gray area.
I want to remind everybody that if you'd like to join in on our conversation, give us your opinion. Our number is 479-1080, 479-1080. Now, Doctor, there's this controversy over whether she is really in what is called a persistive vegetative state, argument between the family and the husband, and apparently the doctors, because you wouldn't get this far if she wasn't. They're saying there is a chance for rehabilitation. How do doctors come to that determination? What is it that you have to determine? I mean, you see the films of her. It looks like she's looking at people. She's making sounds when they say things to her. Of course, then people will also tell me that, well, apparently the nurses have said that she makes the same sounds when they're not there. So it's not like this is something special when her mother walks in the room or her father walks in the room. Where and how do you make these determinations? Because we've heard of the stories of people's, well, comas are different, but people being out for years and then reappearing, and they're fine. What do you say? How do you determine what this persistive vegetative state is?
Well, that is a difficult area, and let me make it clear that I'm not a neurologist. I am an internist, but I have a particular interest in this area. Even when you check the textbooks, they never say without leaving a little bit of wiggle room that after a few days of existing in this persistent vegetative state, that it's very, very unlikely that the patient would ever be able to have any kind of recovery. And, of course, she's been in this for years. Now, the very reason that you have heard of some of these people responding reflects two things. Number one, as you just made very clear, it's not always exactly the same kind of coma. There are lots of different kinds of comas, and sometimes there are a higher likelihood of some kinds of comas of people waking up and in others. Persistent vegetative state is one where there's almost a zero likelihood. But that's why they call this the art of medicine and not the science of medicine, and they call it the practice of medicine. Nothing is 100%. But what happens is, and that this makes it so hard on the family, what happens is the persistent vegetative state is, it reminds me of the little baby doll that I used to have when I was a little girl, and eyes closed when you lay them down and the eyes open when you set them up.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes when you'd lay them down, the eyes would stay open. And then if you watched for a while, they got stuck, so to speak. If you watched for a while, all of a sudden the eyes would close. And you'd get this, as a kid, you get this spooky feeling that maybe was that doll really alive? No, it was just a mechanical thing that happened. And part of the definition of vegetative state is that there are random eye movements, random grunting, random movements. And if you come in at and say tape a person in vegetative state for say a month, you would see them making these kinds of random movements and things that appear to be purposeful. But if the diagnosis is accurate in her case, it's not purposeful, it's random.
Now,
if you happen to walk in at the moment 2 seconds before she's going to make a random movement and say, hi, how are you? And then she moves. That's easy to interpret as a purposeful response when, as you said, nurses say she makes those kind of movements all the time when there's no one else.
So we have a caller. They like to ask a question of you, Doctor. Wanda from Watsonville. Wanda.
Hi. You know, life support, right? I know I see this woman on television, and I feel really bad for her family. But I also know that her husband has a new woman and two children. And I don't know if I'd want him making up his mind whether I should live or die. And, you know, there are other people that are far worse off maybe than this woman. Let's start killing the criminally insane or people that are doing life in prison. Hospitals are full of severely handicapped people. We should start getting rid of all them then. This woman has a family that wants to take care of her. Relieve the husband of it. He got $1 million. And I think the reason he doesn't divorce her, he might have to split it.
Well, that's interesting. Well, it does say here that $350,000 of the malpractice settlement awarded to Schiavo was used for her. And, you know, if it was $1 million, then $300,000 went to the attorney and $300,000 went to the husband. So that's basically what was left after it happens. The attorneys take all of the money. Well, thanks, Wanda, for calling.
Oh, you're very welcome. Can I make one more comment?
Yes, go ahead.
Why are we keeping, you know, a suicide watch on this man who has confessed to killing this little 9-year-old girl? Mm. They should hand him a rope in his cell and give him 15 minutes. That's my comment for the day.
There you are.
Thanks.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Juan. Well, Doctor, you know, that's a lot of emotion there. People on one side. Now, I saw earlier today, the Wall Street Journal is taking a poll. 75% said that the government should stay out of this. Personally, I believe that too. I just don't see how the government and the politicians should be weighing in on these personal family matters other than the fact, I mean, this is what we're stuck with, is the fact that she didn't have this proper living will.
Well, I couldn't agree more. The point that the caller brought up is extremely pertinent. In this case, the husband is not a sympathetic figure. And the fact that there is some secondary gain for him, and it's very clear that there are other factors at play, make it very difficult to separate that from what is best for this woman. When you look at him and his motivation, that colors your decision about what would be best for his wife.
Well, he keeps claiming this is what she said, and apparently there were some friends that also said that she mentioned this. Of course, people say, well, when did you talk about this? Well, I talk with my wife about the same. I mean, you don't talk about it at any particular time. You might see a television show. It might be, you know, when you're going to sleep. I don't know. These types of things aren't like the topic of the day. What are you going to do if I'm a vegetable? I guess it's just a very, it's an upsetting situation. We got Pat in Santa Cruz with a comment. Pat, what's on your mind?
Yeah, hi. I think that this is an important subject, and it's been hushed up way too much, and it's a big taboo, and it's good to hear you talking about it. People need to actually understand that this can happen to any of us, and do we want to impose that on anybody else that's going to have to take care of us? Personally, I don't, and I have told anybody that knows me, if there's any question as to whether to pull the plug, the default position is yes. That is my last will and testament. Mm-hmm. And as medical technology keeps people from death, but in these very dubious states of life for longer and longer periods, and as the technology gets more and more expensive, we can say you can't put a price on life, but let's face it, we're going to have to come to terms with that, especially as the government is not budgeting as much money for medical care as we think they ought to be, and that's their facts of life. Also, I lost the train of my thought here, so I'll let you go.
That's okay.
I know one last thing I would like to say here.
Sure.
Jack Kevorkian really got set up. He did not trick anybody into dying. And you can say he was not a charismatic figure, or you can criticize his art or anything you want, but the guy actually performed a very valuable service, and he's doing hard time in prison right now. Nobody's leading rallies to free Jack Kevorkian, and the guy's completely forgotten by the political left and the political right, and all he did was help people end their suffering, and that guy is a hero. So thank you.
Listen, thanks a lot, Pat. Doctor, what about that? Obviously, Dr. Kevorkian was, I think, what was it, using carbon monoxide, or I don't know exactly what he was doing to put...
He was hooking patients up to IVs, mm-hmm. and doing a similar kind of situation as when a prisoner is executed by lethal injection.
Mm-hmm. Now, this is one of the questions. You're limited in how you can let this person die, right? I mean, in this instance, we're basically going to starve this person to death. Now, I've understood, and I don't know this completely. Maybe you can help me out here, but I understand that people that are near death actually lose their need for food and water. They don't have that feeling. Of course, how do you know? I mean, isn't this the crux of the matter? I mean, we're going to, okay, now the decision has been made, but you can't administer a drug like when I take my little Sheba dog down and have her put down. You can't do that with a person, right?
No, you absolutely can't. However, you can treat whatever level of discomfort that the individual is demonstrating. And we have some evidence that when patients do near death, that their level of hunger and thirst diminishes. What we can see is whether the person is in distress or not. And if they are, for whatever reason, then it's appropriate to give them whatever medication would be necessary to relieve their distress. It's never okay to give them medication to terminate their life, but it's always appropriate to give them medication to keep them from suffering. And I wanted to make a point that one of the earlier callers brought up, actually two things she said. One is, if we're going to kill people, we're not killing people. The natural process that has put the person in this situation is what kills the person. We're stopping the natural process. We're not killing people. Mm-hmm. And she also made, or you did, about the comment about Congress. I could not agree more that Congress has absolutely no business getting involved in this. So if they're going to prepare legislation on individually for every single case of every single person who's in this kind of situation, they'll find themselves having bitten off more than they could ever mm-hmm. hope to chew. There are situations like this all the time, and it's totally inappropriate for legislators to be getting involved in healthcare decisions, particularly on the micro level such as this. That's not their job. They have other things much more important for the country to do than make decisions that ethical and medical minds and families should be making. It's not appropriate.
I have to say I totally agree with you, and I think it's partly also part of the season. It's Easter. It's Palm Sunday weekend. People are even more intensified in their religious values and their thoughts, and the family is a very religious Catholic family who doesn't believe in any of the euthanasia. I remember I grew up in a Catholic household. I went to school in a parochial school for 8 years. We talked about euthanasia. I mean, it was one of the big subjects, the idea that, well, when you get too old, society will then put you out to pasture, and then eventually, when you can't even stand up in the pasture, well, let's just, get rid of that person. This isn't anywhere near. This is really a quality of life issue. She can't go out and go to the store. She can't do any of the normal things. She can't have a conversation with anybody. But the family still holds to this hope that something is there. And I'm sure, as a doctor, you've had to deal with this constantly if you're dealing with these right-to-life issues or these end-of-life issues.
And yes, you're exactly right. As a geriatrician with an interest in end-of-life care, this is something I speak about all over the country. And And I'm asked sometimes this question, don't you believe in miracles? And as a Christian physician, that's something that I struggle with as well. I believe in miracles, but I can't discount what all of the numbers and what all of the tests that we can perform tell us. I'm not going to be so arrogant as to say that I can decide whether there's going to be a miracle or not. And a friend of mine helped me with this thought process, and he's a Jesuit priest as well as an MD. And he said, you know, the problem is we decide what is the miracle that we expect God to perform. And the miracle may be bringing more people to an understanding of the fragility of life. What we say, we want a miracle, and then we want to tell God what that miracle needs to be. And that's not how it works.
We've got Joe in Salinas on the line. Joe, what say you?
Yeah, you know, she's bringing up spirituality, but she's bringing up spirituality to push death. We need to bring up spirituality to affirm life and affirm that when you have a family that wants to take care of you, who loves you, yes, Congress absolutely does need to get involved, because the courts, they impose themselves all the time on all these little issues, and they've overstepped themselves far too much. So it's about time for Congress to rein them in and for Congress to get involved, and even the president to get involved if need be.
But, Joe, how can you take each instance of this type of a situation and have Congress be doing that? I mean, it just doesn't seem possible. And you can't legislate. Everything's going to be different. There's going to be a little nuance or difference, right, doctor, in every case?
Yes, that's absolutely
so,
true.
So how do you do that, Joe?
Well, I mean, look what the courts are doing on the Ten Commandments and all these things, and they're imposing themselves in the rights of privacy and sodomy and all those things. They're imposing themselves. They're micromanaging lives. They're micromanaging when people want to say the Pledge of Allegiance or put up monuments. They're micromanaging all these things.
Okay, well, we'll take it at that. I understand what you're saying, I guess, to a certain point, doctor. I mean, I suppose, you know, I don't know. I don't like micromanaging. And maybe they are doing that to some extent on some of these other issues. But, you know, this is a primary issue of the really, especially the religious right. That's where this is fermenting up with the Tom DeLay in Congress and, you know, putting his foot down and running all around. And I know this is where I sort of break off with my conservative group. I'm a more conservative person, but I don't believe in these interferences in family and these particular issues. I don't think they, you know, cut the mustard. I know how important it is, but I just don't see how the government can be looking over every single case. It's just impossible.
And I couldn't agree more. And I think one of the points that is overlooked sometimes, I would certainly beg to differ with the caller that I'm pushing death, or anyone who is looking at this is pushing death. From my point of view, death is not, on this earth, is not the end of life. So keeping someone in a state here that doesn't allow them to recognize and participate in what's happening here on earth is not the be-all and end-all.
Well, I guess
we've got a better life ahead.
Well, these people would be against the death penalty, of course. This is the kind of group that would surround. They just believe that it's God's decision and it's divine decision when somebody actually dies. But we know more today, I think, because of the, if you want to believe that way, then you also have to believe that God has provided us with the tools to know when someone is not there anymore, that it's just a shell of a body.
And I would make that exact point. If we're going to say that God is the sole determinant, then we shouldn't be using any of our medical technology to intervene in any of these and leave it up to God to make the decisions. We're intervening and stopping what the natural process would be in this disease. And I think one of the earlier callers made a very good point about technology. Technology always outstrips the accompanying piece, which is the ethics of the technology. And we can do things before we know whether or not we should do those things. The ethics debates always come later, and unfortunately, we haven't reached the level of sophistication in this country where we think about the ethics before we think about the technology. So that's how we have come to these positions. And I also want to make the point, a lot of people think, well, I don't need to think about this issue because I'm young. And what you will find when you look at a large percentage of the case law in end of life in the United States, it's been determined by the young person who has gotten into a kind of situation like this that they didn't anticipate and for which they gave no direction. And those people are the ones that have eventually led us to the case law that is taking us down the path of where we're going in end-of-life care. Mm-hmm. I had an opportunity to speak about end-of-life care in one of our mini medical school sessions that we hold at Chicago Osteopathic for the community in the fall, and there was a woman there in her 20s, and I could tell she wasn't very pleased to hear about death and dying. And she came back to our next series a couple of weeks ago, and she came up to me and she said, I wanted to thank you for speaking about death and dying last fall. Your lecture was really creepy and I really hated it. And I said, then why are you thanking me for that lecture that you felt was creepy and that you hated? And she said, because your lecture was on a Tuesday night. It was so disturbing to me that I went home and talked to my friends, to my parents, and the next day I talked to my friends at school, and she said the following Saturday, my best friend was killed in a car accident, and she survived for a couple of days before she succumbed to the injuries, and she said we could handle it because we knew what she wanted because we had just talked about it.
Yeah.
So she said, I didn't want to talk about it, but thank you so much because we were able to know what her wishes were just a few days later. She was crying. I was crying. It still gives me goosebumps.
Yeah, reality.
Have to talk about these.
Yeah, when reality hits home, it really brings a lot of understanding to the subject. We have Bob in Monterey. Bob, what do you have on your mind?
Well, I was thinking about what the former caller said about micromanagement of government and issues like this. Once a law gets on the books, it's impossible to change. And in looking at this particular case where just, I think it was yesterday, there was a policeman outside the door. Her attorney was in the room with her and told by the policeman that she has to leave. Another caller talked about, well, who makes the decision whether somebody lives or dies? If you're helping someone to live and someone arrives and says, okay, you have to leave, stop what you're doing, then you are eliminating one process in favor of another, and it's an arbitrary decision. I go back to what a former caller said about the family having the will to be there and fight for their daughter or their child's life. Should they have the right, or should the policeman outside the door, or the government? And again, it gets back to once the laws are on the books, you're stuck with it. In the meantime, we have a media circus in which nobody on this end of the radio can do anything constructive about this other than discourse or opinion. And finally, what I'd ask you to discuss over the air is, what is the money involved, and isn't everything being driven by money these days?
Mm. Okay, well, that's a good question, Doctor. Is it just the money? Obviously, in her case, I think that the hospice is picking up some of it now, and Medicare or Medicaid, one of the two, because obviously all of the award money is gone by now after 10 years. Is it the money? I don't know. I mean, can you go that far?
I don't think so. I think that, unfortunately, if things don't add up, then it's probably because the money is involved. However, I certainly don't think that that's the family's motivation, and I couldn't begin to look into people's souls and you know, all the people involved and make the decision of what is making motivating them to do what they're doing. But
now the husband has this right because technically he's still married, even though I guess he's fathered a couple of other children with somebody else who he's not married to yet. If they were divorced, would then that pass on to the family? Would the divorce cut off the husband's right to decide?
Yes. Yes, it would.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously,
I wouldn't want somebody that I divorced deciding whether to pull the plug or not. I guess that pretty makes sense.
Right. The most states have surrogacy laws, and the spouse is the first person with the legal right to make the decisions if there's been no one else designated by the person in conflict, and then the parents are next, and then adult children are next, and then it goes. Some different states have different laws after that.
Okay,
but it's there's no black at this point. There in this case, there's no black and white. It's all gray.
We've got Jim in Santa Cruz. What's your comment, Jim?
Yes, well, a couple of times religious or the family's religious beliefs have brought up Catholicism. And I think when you bring that into the picture, you have to at some point define what do you mean by end of life. The doctor will probably be able to help with this. But I understand, my understanding would be that the Catholic Church has no objection if someone were to die, that you're not required to keep them, for instance, on a tracheotomy and a ventilator, as they just did to the Holy Father, for instance, to save his life. But if you define food and water to this woman as heroics, I don't think that's I think that goes beyond the pale of what we're talking about here. This woman is breathing. This woman is, you know, is not being provided heroic medicine, and there are so many things that the other caller mentioned about that haven't come forward in the press. There's a question that the press isn't talking about: is the judge in this case legally blind? Is he able to view the pictures of the woman? And they said that he is legally blind. Now this may be one of those internet things or not. But it certainly, there's all those kind of questions out there to be asked. This judge cannot read a brief or anything unless someone does it for him. And I just, that there's too many unanswered questions here to be cutting this woman off from food and water at this time.
Okay. Well, now, you know, doctor, I guess food and water is life-saving to her. She can't eat on her own, right? Body is sort of contracted. Her arms are contracted now. I mean,
well, even if they weren't, she would not. I have to make a very important point here. We're not talking about food and water. That is not the issue. The issue is artificial hydration and nutrition, and that is not the same as food and water. I saw in the news today that a support group was going to symbolically bring her a cup of water. That will not work. She cannot drink. We're not talking about withholding milk and cookies from this woman. We're talking about a medical procedure that does have side effects and complications and consequences.
What is that they're putting in her? What is this? Is it some kind of a concoction?
She's getting something, a formula.
Mm-hmm.
She's getting a formula that they're artificially introducing into the stomach, and it has to go either through a tube through the nose, a tube through the mouth, or a tube directly into the stomach wall. All of those have deadly complications. This is not like saying, well, now you can't bring her cookies anymore. Now you can't feed her favorite spaghetti. If you put that in her mouth, it's just going to sit there. She is not able to eat. We're not talking about food and water. We are talking about a medical procedure that has complications.
I'm glad you cleared that up. We have Margaret in Live Oak. Margaret. Margaret, are you there?
I'm here.
Okay, go ahead.
Hi. Well, you know, children can't eat on their own. Babies in bubbles, you know, where they used to breathe what was it, babies in bubbles or something? They couldn't breathe on their own. They had to have special oxygen. So, I mean, whoop-de-doo. So she's on artificial fluids and nutrition. Good for her. What about people that are on artificial lungs and hearts or whatever? You know, they shouldn't be able to have that either then, should they? Listen, the run-of-the-mill garden variety insurance broker has the education in the background to advise you and carry out your desires on paper and also pen out the financial matters of the end-of-life issues. And, by the way, insurance brokers don't charge a fee like attorneys do, but they can put you in the mature manner that all adults should do to have power of attorney for health care, guardianship of their children, life insurance, mortgage insurance, wills, this sort of thing. And that's with your just garden variety insurance broker.
Well, Margaret, let me ask you, do you think that her husband has a side reason for wanting to let her go? Or is it really, you know, he says she told him that she wanted to go. There's nothing in writing. Isn't that good enough for you?
Pillow talk? Hearsay pillow talk? Come on.
Okay.
The guy's married. He has another...
No, he's not married yet. He's not married yet.
Well, he's common law marriage, whatever.
Okay, okay.
You know, he's got children. He's got a wife. He acts, behaves, looks, thinks, talks like a married man.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, no, the guy's wrong. He has no right. He should just divorce her and be on his little way.
Okay, Margaret, thanks for calling.
Thank you.
Doctor, that's, well, he should be on his merry way and let the family take over here. And also, you have to deal, you know, this, I wanted to get back to this other idea of Congress being involved and micromanaging things. It seems to me if you get Congress involved in these types of things, what's next? I mean, we as an individual have the right to decide whether we want medical care or not, whether we want insulin or whether we want to take a certain type of drug. We can say no. But this person can't say no to that, so somebody has to be there to do it for her. And I just don't like the idea of this advancing into another level where suddenly we've got rules of governments going to tell you when, you know, you're supposed to take your medicine and what you're supposed to do exactly with your body. Isn't that sort of the next step in this level of thinking?
I couldn't agree more. I think you're being very eloquent, and I would certainly say that one of the most important things that you're doing is raising the consciousness of what these issues are and that you have to make your wishes known. And it's not something that you wait until you're 65 to do. You'd better do it as early as you have the opportunity to understand what the issues are. We wouldn't be in this situation. And no amount of laws are going to get us out of this particular situation, but we wouldn't be in this situation if she had taken the opportunity, and many, many other people have taken the opportunity to document what their wishes are. That's just so critical. We have to prevent more of these situations.
So is there, I guess there really shouldn't be any kind of laws in this situation other than make sure you have all of your paperwork done and make sure that you are ready for this kind of situation, really, no matter what your age. And I'm sure one of the callers, we have talked a lot about Catholicism here being involved in the decision because the family is Catholic. I'm sure you have probably found the different religions having different flavors on this particular subject. Is that correct?
Well, actually, no.
Okay.
I have studied that rather extensively to see what Judaism and Catholicism and the various Protestants and Islam and such say about this, and actually they're all pretty uniform. They come down on the side of the person being able to determine what they would want their wishes to be, and that there is sanctity of life with the ability to make your own decision, but that keeping a person on all of these life support mechanisms when they can no longer respond to their surroundings is not our ultimate goal. Our ultimate goal is where we're going after this life. So we don't have time to cite all the traditions and all of the examples, but actually there's a lot of uniformity. And the Pope had a recent encyclical on end-of-life care where they also spoke in favor of sanctity of life, but that it was not necessary to keep a person on life support indefinitely to meet that requirement of sanctity of life. I thought it was an extremely enlightened view, and I would urge everybody to read that. And he spoke very eloquently on that point.
We've got time for one more caller, Bruce in Brookdale. What is on your mind today, Bruce?
Well, if the parents get her, they can't support her, so we're going to have to support her. Like I said, this could go on for many, many, many cases. The money that they're paying for her could support so many other handicapped people. But if God doesn't want her to die, she's not going to die, if there is a God, which I personally don't believe. You couldn't stop her from dying if God didn't want her to die. Maybe God wants to see her. You know, we're interfering.
Mm-hmm.
That's all.
Okay, thanks a lot, Bruce. I appreciate that. I guess you deal with that type of a situation, too. There are non-believers, period, that this is, if it is God's decision and they take her off the tube, then she'll live. I mean, you know, we know you can't live without food of some kind. Right, Doctor?
That's absolutely true. And again, we have to make the distinction between food, and a lot of people who have woken up from so-called comas were still able to eat and drink on their own. She's not in that situation, and if the tube does remain out, she will not be able to sustain life more than a number of days, maybe just a few weeks. But one of the things that we also teach in medical schools is that you honor the person's autonomy to make their own decisions, but you got to know what the decisions are.
And that's the whole critical thing here. Dr. Karen Nichols, I want to thank you from Midwestern University's Chicago College of Osteopathic Medicine and chairman of the End of Life Committee for the American Osteopathic Society. I really appreciate you being with us today and giving us your insight. You've really, you know, I think given everybody a couple of additional thoughts there to think of.
Thank you.
Okay.
I appreciate you bringing the question.
Thanks a lot, Doctor.
Thank
well,
you.
There you go for this hour. That's it. We have a conundrum to deal with, ladies and gentlemen, but I think if there's anything you can do out there, go get your will, go get your living trust, and start looking at it seriously. Make sure people know what you want. This is the perfect time of year. It's Easter. We all would wish that Terry would rise back up and be herself again. I don't think anybody doesn't want that type of a situation to happen, but it looks as though from the doctors, from what they've said, that that isn't going to happen. And obviously now with the tube being pulled, it's probably only a matter of time before she is gone. So, we pray for her and her family, and all those involved, and that's probably the best we can do. Okay, coming up next hour, we're going to have a very interesting guest. We're going to talk about your Social Security and your taxes and the government's involvement in all that garbage. Boy, it's really getting there with these idea of private accounts, and is it a good idea? Should we doodle around with Social Security? Is it about ready to go out? Well, that's what we're going to talk about next hour, so I hope you'll stay tuned for that. And by the way, if you put it down on your little paper there, the number to call if you want to join in on our conversation is 479-1080, 479-1080. This is Roger Pasquier sitting in for MZ. You're listening to KSEO Santa Cruz.
USA Radio Network News, Richard Curtis reporting. Authorities have recovered the body of missing Richard Curtis, USA Radio Network News.
Good morning. It is 5 past 11 a.m. this Saturday, March 19th, 2005. And in the weather today, we're looking at periods of rain, highs in the mid-50s to mid-60s, southeast winds 10 to 20 miles per hour, becoming southwesterly. Tonight, periods of rain as well, lows in the 40s, lower 50s, southwest winds 5 to 15 miles per hour. Looks pretty sunny outside the station. But we are on the coast, so it just might be here on the coast. On the bay, we're looking at small craft advisory today through Wednesday. And southwest winds, 10 to 20 knots. Wind waves, 2 to 4 feet. West southwestern swells, 5 to 10 feet. At 11-second intervals. Just for your information out there, if anybody's traveling over 17, do take Summit Road exit. There is an estate sale at the preschool there. Anyways, we are going to take you to the second hour of the Saturday special with your host, Roger Pasquire.
Hey, good after Saturday noon. No, it's not noon yet. I'm thinking about last week. It's 11:06. I'm filling in for MZ today, Roger Pasquire. You're getting the Pasquire perspective again today. I know everybody in Santa Cruz is probably out there going, when'd you get this guy on the air for again? Okay, we'll deal with it. We know you have a problem out there, you ultra-liberals. But I'm not an ultra-conservative. On this last subject, I don't agree with Republicans sticking their nose in right-to-life issues. Not right-to-life issues, I'm sorry. End-of-life issues. And I just think it's wrong. So I think the families aren't prepared. So, you know, everybody has to get their nose into it. It's political. They've got to make a statement for their group that backs them at the polls. We don't get good independent analysis that way, unfortunately. Well, Social Security is on the table this year. It's everybody's, Peck's bad boy, I guess, if you want to call it, thought of the year. We have to deal with this. I don't think that I ever thought that Social Security was really going to take care of me. I mean, did you think Social Security was going to cover your nut when the guy says, hey, you're out of here, you got to retire? I don't think so. And really, what kind of a program is it? It's nothing but a Ponzi scheme, folks. Don't you see that? It's a Ponzi scheme. One guy pays for the next guy and the next guy, and then finally, well, we run into problems. 2017, that's when we begin paying out more than we bring in. That's when it's less workers for every person out there. And, of course, this all has to do with the demographic problem that we have sitting in our face, the baby boomers, you and I, some of you anyway. That is what really is one of the big problems. Then in 2047, the reserves are totally exhausted. And at that time, we would be, if we do nothing, we would be confronting basically the fact that we'd have to lower the benefits by something like 70% and have a big increase in tax. Well, right now, there's all this controversy. Of course, President Bush has brought this to the forefront. And I want to say thank you, President Bush, for bringing this to the forefront. Now, I don't care if you agree with his idea on privatizing Social Security or not. At least the guy is saying something. We've got to do something about it. And if you don't think we have to, well, you're living with your head in the sand. We need a solution. We need to talk about this. And that's why we are going to hopefully have, as a guest on our show, Carrie Houston, who is Vice President of Policy Frontiers of Freedom. We should be getting her on the phone line pretty soon, hopefully. But what are we going to do? Is it just now the Democrats, basically what their idea is less benefits, more taxes. That's what they say. Now, Bush has come in with this privatization thing, but I think it's becoming clear that the privatization idea is not the idea of the major thing that'll save Social Security. There's going to have to be more to it than that. But really, this is kind of coming into the play as a rich versus poor type of situation. There's all sorts of different types of things we can do, mean testing and, all sorts of nasty little things. But Social Security is something that, well, everybody thinks of as depending on, I think I got one of my figures the other day. I don't know how much it is, $1,000 a month or something if I don't work anymore, whatever. I don't know how much it can go up to, but the idea is it's not going to take care of you, really. They talk about it as a multi-trillion dollar problem. Now, they say that if we privatize any portion of it, which I think Bush is talking about 4%, we're talking about costing us $2 trillion. But the fact is we've apparently, what I've understood of this, we've got about a $9 trillion problem if we do nothing. If we do nothing. So we are going to have to do something. And the privatization idea, of course, I think is a way of changing the program from purely what they call a pay-as-you-go program to acting more like a savings system. And somebody on one of the talk shows this morning said, well, why don't we just take the money that's in there now? Take the money that's in there now and just start, reinvesting it in a different way. Instead of putting it in treasury bills, well, we'll start buying some bonds. I don't know. I don't want the government making decisions about that. I don't want some official guy. And I think we all have to live up to the fact we're going to have to figure out a way to take care of ourselves in our older age. Now, if you want to comment on this, our phone number is 479-1080, 479-1080. And we're still waiting to hear from our special guest, Carrie Houston. I don't know. Do you have her on there? Is she in? Is she on the line? Oh, there she is. Oh, great. Carrie, how are you? Are you there with me?
I am. How are you?
Hey, great. Thank you for joining me today on this very interesting conversation. Carrie Houston is a public policy analyst and expert in media marketing and external relations for public policy institutes. She is, you're a working member of the National Paycheck Protection Working Group. I mean, you're involved in all sorts of different things. You've written for the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Times, the Dallas Morning News, Forbes Magazine, and you've been on all sorts of television shows, MSNBC, CNBC. Okay, let's...
You make me sound important.
I'm trying to, because I need somebody more important than me.
Oh, dear, we can't have that.
Anyway, okay, you know, Social Security is right here in front of our face, and I know there's several topics that you can talk on today, judicial reform and that type of thing, but, you know, the Social Security thing is right square in our face, and I want to also let people know, if you want to call in and join our conversation, our number here is 831-479-1080. That's 479-1080. So, Ms. Houston, okay, what do we have to do? What's going to happen? Is privatization the key to this thing, or?
Well, I think there are four keys, actually, Roger. And I will say right up front that I am an unmitigated supporter of ownership accounts, of you actually owning your retirement savings, being able to pass it on to your spouse or your family when you pass away, being allowed, you know, growth, which, of course, we don't get. You get more money sticking your you'll get more return sticking your money in the mattress right at the moment than investing in Social Security at the government level. So, yes, but I think that we're having a conversation about it kind of in a vacuum, and I think that there are other things that we have to look at. I think the fundamental question, which I would like to pose to the nation as opposed to sort of the narrow Social Security privatization question, is what is this about, really? I sat back the other day after going to a big meeting on Social Security, and I was just sitting in my car in the parking lot, and I thought to myself, you know, this is about people having retirement wealth. This is about people being better off financially when they retire. Why can't we make it about that? Why does it have to be a question of, do we keep the big government program? Do we get rid of the big government program? What does big government do for us? And I think that if we can sort of turn it around and refocus on the notion that what we really do, certainly what I want to do, and I know most of my colleagues do, is just have people be wealthier when they're old. It's just very simple, wealthier and healthier. And again, Social Security is one of the things we can do, the reforming thereof, which doesn't affect anybody who is retired right now, no matter what anybody else says. It absolutely doesn't touch people over the age of 55. But I think there are three other things we can do as well that are critically important to garnering wealth for older folks. One is really promoting and pushing health savings accounts. Three is promoting and pushing long-term care health insurance, which I have now signed up for after seeing what my parents have gone through with putting my dad in a nursing home this year. And the other one is just blowing the caps off IRAs and letting people save as much money tax-free for retirement as they possibly can.
That sounds like some pretty good ideas. I think that the idea that even Alan Greenspan was mentioning, that privatization is a good idea because it gives people who naturally or mostly haven't been able to take advantage, you know, buying stocks or being in bonds. A lot of people just don't even get into that. They buy their CD, they put their money away, or like as with Social Security, that's what they're counting on. This is really a subject, you know, that is near and dear to my heart. I know that. Now, listen, we've got Cecil in Boulder Creek on the air. I'd like to have his question. What do you have to say, Cecil?
Well, first off, I just want to say now I'm hoping like my Social Security is actually going to help me retire because I'm planning on that stuff. And I just want to say I think like, you know, I got George Bush spending like a drunken sailor. And another problem is like this lady, what is her job title like, you know, cook, fireman? It's like advanced lady. You know what I'm saying? I just like, you know, I'm planning on my Social Security. I've been paying that for the rest of my life. And it better, like, support me because I'm planning on it.
Now, how old are you, Cecil?
Well, I'm 49 years old.
Okay, so you're under the – so something may change. Are you going to be happy if they take more out of your paycheck to put it in a savings account, for instance, that gets basically tenths of an interest?
They need to take them people that are making a whole bunch more money than little Cecil. You know what I'm saying?
I see. You're talking about means testing. Okay, Carrie, what is means testing? Carrie? Oh, my goodness, did I lose Carrie? I guess I lost her, huh? She got disengaged, so we're going to have to find her. I've got Steve on the line right now. Steve.
Yes, hi. You talked about the unfunded liability of Social Security, and you mentioned like $9 trillion. I had heard figures more like $5 trillion. And it's like going to be about 40 years before we're actually going to have a problem, I think. But we have a way bigger problem with Social Security than the unfunded liability. And by the way, private accounts aren't going to do anything to solve that. They might even cost us more money. The only thing that it'll give us is a better return. I agree with that. But right now, we're running a huge deficit. So essentially, George Bush and the proponents, and I agree with Alan Greenspan normally, want to increase our deficit, I guess. But that's not really my point. My point is our bigger problem is, I think, it's Medicaid, which is like $12 trillion.
Oh,
taking care of elderly people's health, and we're increasing their drug benefits. And we need to address this. Serious problems we have, not some kind of phantom problem that's 40 years. We have immediate problems now. The deficit, Medicaid, these are real problems, immediate ones.
Now, let me ask you this, Steve. How old are you?
39.
So you've got a lot of time. You're thinking about it's a lot of time ahead. Now, have you started your own savings program other than Social Security?
Well, sure. Yeah, we've got lots of different ways that we can save up for retirement.
So, you know, Congress has a savings program where they put part of their money into a program, but they don't want that for you to be able to have that. Don't you think you should be able to have that option of being able to put a little percentage of something into a growing investment instead of just the treasury bills and that they are put in?
I agreed with privatization 10 years ago when I saw that Chile was doing it. And they were following that model. And I think we should have done that when we had a budget surplus. And, yeah, I already do that. I have a 401k. I think we probably are set up because I've been planning for it in other ways. And, yeah, I agree with privatization, but I don't agree with increasing our deficit and coming up with some made-up problem when we have real immediate problems. And the made-up. Okay, we get 2-3% right now with Social Security. That other person said you could make more money putting it on the mattress. You lose 3% a year. The opposite is true. You'd end up with very little at the end if you put it under your mattress. Yeah, Social Security, hey, you could get probably 6% in the market even if you invested in AAA, you know, rated Jenny Mays or something. But, and I agree with that, and I do think we should be able to put some away and have it in our own accounts. But I don't think that's the problem.
Okay.
I think the problem is Medicaid.
Okay, well, listen, thank you, thank you, Steve. We've got Carrie back on the line. I'm sorry about that, Carrie. I didn't double-click the computer correctly.
That's okay. I thought maybe it was the gremlins who didn't want us to privatize Social Security were.
Did you hear any of the callers?
I didn't, unfortunately.
Okay, basically what they were saying is you know, they're very nervous about this whole thing, and I think that they just don't want to come to grips with the fact that they say, well, this is 47 years out there. We've got deficits. We've got Medicare, Medicaid, all these other problems to take care of. What do you say to that?
If I go to the doctor because I have a runny nose and a stomach ache and a headache, I'm not going to say to the doctor, could you just cure my runny nose today? We have to do all of these things. Social Security is just a matter of money. We need to fix the system to make sure that current retirees are getting the benefits that they are entitled to, and that future retirees, people in their 20s and 30s and 40s, have a better retirement plan than today's retirees. We do have a problem with Medicare. Medicare is huge. And Medicare isn't just like just money, as Social Security reform is. Medicare is you know, taking care of people's health, moving into a system where people have more choice and more access. It is enormous, and it's actually financially in worse shape than Social Security. As far as deficits go, the deficits are fine, really. As a percentage of GDP, as a percentage of economic growth, the aggregate numbers are high, but as a percentage of growth, they're the lowest they've been in a very, very long time. So if you look at raw numbers, they're big because the economy is growing. But if you look at the percentage of deficit versus output, it's really not so bad. And I think we are growing our way out of that deficit a little bit. So circling back, Social Security is a huge problem. It's going to go broke at some point. So you can have the financial argument. In 2018, it starts paying out more money than it has in. And somewhere around 2042, it's completely out of money. If you circle back the argument again, what we have to do is make a moral case for it as well. It's not just about money. It's about morality, too, and what's right for people and what's right for the government to be interfering. I mean, right now, if you are getting Social Security and you're a married couple and one spouse passes away, they've been living on two Social Security checks for however long, and one spouse leaves, and that remaining spouse is only living now on one retirement check, not two. If you have ownership in your retirement savings, which I think that everybody has the right to have, then when the one spouse passes away, that money that the person has saved all those years through his hard work now goes to that remaining spouse.
Mm-hmm.
So you have an estate there. You've built up money, and you're not leaving the remaining spouse in a really bad financial pickle because you do own that money. Right now you don't own it. The government owns it, and that's why we have Congress tinkering with it. That's why they can tinker with your retirement savings, because you don't own it.
Hey, we're talking with Carrie Houston, Vice President of Policy Frontiers of Freedom. We're talking about Social Security and taxes and Medicare and a whole bunch of other things. If you want to join in, it's 479-1080. We'll be right back after this break.
If you think you missed the boat on low mortgage rates, think again. This is Jim Chubb with Pacific Inland with more good news for homeowners and home buyers. There are still mortgage loan programs that offer low rates and lower payments than you can possibly imagine. If your goal is to save money on mortgage payments, pull cash out for any reason, or to pay your home off early, please call Pacific Inland today at 475-2600. That's Pacific Inland at 475-2600, licensed by the California Department of Real Estate.
This is Gordon Smith. I'm president of Pacific Gas and Electric Company. It's winter storm season, and although all of us at PG&E work hard to prepare for and minimize storm-related outages, some things are only in Mother Nature's control. If an outage occurs, remember that the people at PG&E are working hard to get the power back on, and that the most important thing for you to do is to keep safe. Please stay inside and report any downed power lines immediately by calling 1-800-PGE-5000. Don't try to touch or move lines. Leave that to PG&E's trained professionals. And remember, you should also turn off or even unplug appliances, if possible, to prevent equipment damage and fire hazards when power does come back on. Of course, being prepared is the best way to stay safe and warm. Our website has tips to get your home storm ready, so please visit pge.com. On behalf of the 20,000 men and women of Pacific Gas and Electric Company, thank you and stay safe.
It's out there, an insidious addiction plaguing literate people of Santa Cruz County. It starts innocently enough. You pick it up at a friend's house as a lark. It makes you feel enlightened. Pretty soon you're buying it on the street. The more you use it, the smarter you feel. Then before you know it, you're having it delivered to your home. I'm talking, of course, about the Santa Cruz Sentinel. It hooks you with a headline, then story after story. The Sentinel feeds your craving for knowledge. Every day, something new to stimulate your mind. There are even comics to trick your children into reading more, leading them to the harder stuff, like books. Beware, Santa Cruz County. The Sentinel is out there. Read it, and you may never be content to live in ignorance again. The Santa Cruz Sentinel. Your news, your stories, every day.
And every Sunday, the Sentinel features insight with world and local views and opinions, Santa Cruz style, featuring stories about the lifestyle in Santa Cruz County, plus financial news in the Sunday Wall Street Journal. The Sunday Sentinel. Check it out.
We've been in business for 29 years, and we'd like to thank you for your support. Hello, I'm Linda Radford, owner of Linda's Bible Bookstore, with an invitation for you to join us at Linda's Bible Bookstore Saturday from 9:30 to 5:30. We'll have live talks from 9 of the top authors in Christian literature. Check lindasbible.com for a schedule of appearances. Linda's Bible Bookstore is celebrating 29 years of your support. Please join us Saturday. We're on Soquel Drive across from Dominican Hospital. Thank you.
Okay, we're back. This is Roger Pasquier filling in for MZ on the Saturday special. We're talking this hour about Social Security with Carrie Houston, Vice President of Policy Frontiers of Freedom. So, what are all of the potential, well, I guess it's a lot to say, the options for us? Obviously, the Democrats are saying, well, let's just raise the taxes a little bit and lower the age bracket, but there are many other things that can be done. I know President Bush has sort of wanted to stay out of it at this point. He wants everybody else to come up with the ideas, and I guess then he's going to come in and overlay with his thoughts. Where are we on that?
Well, I think the way you framed it, Roger, is exactly right. You know, the president keeps saying everything is on the table, and at this point, he certainly means it. Most conservative Republicans are not in favor of raising taxes and nor lowering the age, because one of the promises that the president has made to the American people is that any kind of retirement savings reform is not going to change or alter in any way benefits for people 55 and under. So, even if the age was to be raised at when you can get your Social Security benefits, he certainly wouldn't do it for anybody. He wouldn't allow it to go through for anyone 55 or older. So basically we're talking about raising the age for younger people who are also able to, or would be also under the voluntary system, to invest in private accounts. So one of the things you hear a lot is that the president and the Republicans in Congress want to lower benefits for you if you're a younger worker. And they go around denying this, but in fact it's true. They're lowering government benefits, what they're doing. So if now you take, just for the sake of argument, 3% of your money if you're a 30-year-old worker and you put it in the government system, which, by the way, is voluntary. You don't have to privatize yourself. You can if you choose to. You take your other 3% and you put it in your private account. That 3% that you put in the private account is still money. It's still growing. It's now yours. And it does offset that amount of money which the government will owe you. So when you hear Democrats say, oh, they're going to cut benefits for younger workers, well, yeah, they're going to cut government benefits for younger workers, but those younger workers will more than make up for that amount of money in the accounts that they now own themselves, and are also growing. They actually have an interest rate attached to them as opposed to Social Security now.
I've seen some of these options. One, increasing the normal retirement age. How many, you know, for every year that you do that, what kind of savings would you get? Do you know anything about that?
No, I'm sorry. I don't have those numbers in my head. I know they're fairly significant in 2 to 3 year jumps. meaning that if you only do it for 6 months or a year, you don't have a significant amount of savings.
Now, also lowering the cost of living adjustments.
Right. There's a debate whether you tag Social Security growth to cost of living or you tag it to inflation. And, you know, all of those arguments are on the table, too. But I think that, you know, it's interesting, Roger. I guess one of your callers while I was offline was talking about Medicare. And I think there are probably two really main things that seniors worry about. I know certainly in my family it's the case. One is just basically having enough money for retirement, and two is your health care. And as some of the reforms go through, I think we look at some of the other things I mentioned earlier. There are reforms that can go through that are related to retirement savings that have a real and true relief for Medicare. I talked briefly about health savings accounts. I don't know if you're familiar with these, but it's a new way to insure yourself for health care, either through yourself or through your employer, where your employer will put so much money a year in for your basic medical, and then you have a catastrophic or a high deductible policy in case you need hospitalization or anything like that. If you start with an HSA as a young person, the beauty of these things is your employer gives you, say, for example, $2,000 a year to pay your medical expenses. If you're very healthy, you don't use the whole $2,000, and now you can roll that over. So imagine what it would mean for a senior looking at long-term care or paying for prescription drugs or anything else if they have now for, say, you know, 15 or 20 years, been the benefit of a health savings account, and they've rolled these medical dollars over and over and over. That's a great way to make people more secure in the senior years. And again, one of the main causes of problems for people is that hospitalization is so high. Hospitalization is about 40% of any health care budget. So if you look in the senior population, of course, that's where most of the hospitalization occurs. So if you, for younger folks, you know, you have healthcare savings accounts rolling over and you're accumulating medical wealth, you've got a privatized Social Security account, which means you're actually making more, your checks in retirement are more, you're certainly more secure in your healthcare as well. So it's interesting how there's just such a strong dynamic, really, between the two, between healthcare and retirement savings.
It all has to work together in some
way. It does indeed.
We've got Richard in Watsonville on the air. Richard, what is your question or comment?
Well, first question would be, how old are you, Roger?
Ah! You want to know? I'm 50.
Well, you're asking
50.
Everybody else.
I'm 50 years old.
You're 50.
50, the
so
big
five. So you're not even going to be in on this program.
Well, I'll be in something.
You were born, what, 54 or something?
Yeah, right.
You know, I mean, I'm all for getting rid of Medicare for the old people. Let them fend for themselves right now.
Oh, well, I think we have to have some kind of a safety net.
No,
I hope
you're
not going to run for Congress on that platform.
Well, you know, Congress is trying to deal with baseball steroids and crap like that. I mean, they don't want to deal with something as serious as Social Security. And it was Lyndon Johnson that instituted Medicare to begin with. As
right.
a matter of fact, it was Lyndon Johnson that put Social Security into the general fund. And
well,
if he would have never touched it, we would have had so much of a surplus in Social Security right now, it'd be sickening.
Well, you look at the history of Social Security, and when Franklin Roosevelt instituted it, it was supposed to just be a safety net.
That was just Social Security, though. And that was one penny off of $1 that you've put in, and your employee provided a penny.
Now, you're saying they've added all these extra things to Social Security over the years.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Lyndon Johnson is the one that instituted Medicare. At the same time, he had the Social Security money put into the general fund. If they would have just left their – if they would take their hands off of it right now, we wouldn't even be talking about this. As a matter of fact, the – you know, what about – you know, your guest here is very good. I mean, she'd be good as an insurance agent if we're going to live healthy and all this stuff. But she doesn't take in – or she's not mentioning the fact that they're going to charge you a commission for putting your money in. They'll charge you a commission for dishing it out to you.
Okay, Richard. Let's see about that. What is there a commission?
That's news to me.
I've never heard of a commission.
Yeah,
in other words, you need a broker or somebody to tell you what to do. The idea is whatever you would put that 4% or whatever that amount comes out to be, you would end up putting it in basically some very well determined types of accounts, right? What type of accounts would those be, for instance?
Exactly. It's kind of what I call mandated freedom, like you're being forced by the government to be free.
Yeah, you'd be like in the Wilshire 5000, you'd have an index type of a thing. If you wanted to put it in stocks, you could do something like that with bonds, I would suppose.
Exactly. You have two sets of choices, really. The first choice is you can choose to have a private account or choose not to. It'll be totally up to you. No one in the government is going to force you to have a private account. And number two, you'll have a whole range of options for investing that portion of your Social Security into your own account. You could probably do it at a bank where you'll get 2 or 3%. You can do it at a bond where you get maybe 4 or 5%. If you're a younger worker and you're astute enough to recognize that over a 40-year period the stock market always grows, you can put it in some kind of a mutual fund. I certainly would never advise that for someone in their older years, you know. I'm 48, you're 50. I'd love to have a private Social Security account, but I don't think I would put it in a more what you would, I guess, classify as a risky investment. So I think what we'll see happen is the government will set up some kind of a financial advisory board. People will not have to learn how to play the stock market. I cannot tell you how many seniors have said to me, but I don't understand the stock market. I don't want to learn how to play the stock market. That's not going to be the case. I think you'll get a choice of, you know, these are 4 or 5 vehicles that you can put that portion of your money in. You can choose. It's very simple. We'll do it for you. You still have to pay. You know, your employer will still be sending in your Social Security benefits. So from the user end, I don't think it's going to be difficult. It'll be new. Everything new is spooky. But it'll be really not much different than it is now. The big difference will come on the far end when you retire and you actually have money, A, that you own, and B, that has grown over that 10, 20, 30-year period. So I think we can safely assume that the financial markets will be more than happy to take that increased capital, which they can then turn around and grow the economy, and everybody gets to buy jobs and have jobs and buy more stuff. So I can't imagine. I have never, in all the discussions I have sat through, both at the government level and in the public policy level, I have never heard anybody discuss a commission. I think these markets will be so happy to get this investment capital that they'll cheerfully use it both to the benefit of the person who owns it and to their own benefit as well.
Now, Carrie, one of our earlier callers that you missed brought up the idea, when I said, well, who's going to pay for this? He says, well, you know, if you just leave it alone, he's, well, the rich guy, which is another discussion called means testing. Now, that's one of the ways to reduce benefits. In other words, the rich guy doesn't get as much. Is that really fair? Is that American?
No, it's not. It's kind of nasty. I mean, I've never really understood the idea of punishing success, and basically that's what it is. And the other thing we have to look at is, quote-unquote, the rich guy right at the moment, is a lot of those folks that make high income are small entrepreneurs, business owners who employ a whole bunch of people, and because they're a small business, they actually pay taxes at the individual level rather than at a corporate level. And there's about 90% of new job growth comes out of this sector. A lot of it's in the minority sector, as a matter of fact. The Hispanic and the African-American entrepreneur, why on earth would you want to punish that? That's just kind of nutty. You know, punishing the people who are doing well and are responsible for putting money in, again, in capital markets for growth in general and also employing others. Let's tax those who employ others. It's just never been, to my way of thinking, a good idea economically. And two, of course, it's not fair. You know, it's just sort of more sort of creeping socialism and trying to turn us into a country of envy. And I don't think our citizens look at each other that way.
Okay, we've got Margaret in Live Oak on the air. Margaret, what have you got on your mind today?
Hi again. am I on? Hello?
Yeah, you're there. Okay. You're there. Go ahead.
The magic of compound interest. Now, you talk to any CPA or math enthusiast, and he'll tell you, when you have a child age 1, you put $500 into a simple compound interest savings account. By the time this child reaches the age of 60, that $500 will be will have increased to $1 million.
Hey, you know, Margaret, you've got a great idea there, and I heard this on the TV the other night, an idea of an infant account. Every infant that's born gets a $1,000 account. What do you think about that, Carrie?
Well, you know, I'm not a big fan of the government giving anybody's money to anybody else. But that being said, I think that's a great idea.
I mean, you give something, you give the baby, and then in 65 years, what do you got?
Investment. Imagine how much money you would be not forcing other taxpayers to pay if you did that. I really like Margaret. Margaret, you're my friend. You've brought up a really important point, and that is the rate of return. When you look at a younger worker right now, a young white male in his 20s is getting maybe, if he's lucky, about a 1% return on his government Social Security. A black man in his 20s is getting minus 6%, which to my way of thinking basically means that the government is stealing 6% of his retirement savings from him and his family. And that's based on life expectancy tables.
I think I saw when the guy, whoever proposed this idea, was talking it would cost over the period of time $900 billion or something. I don't know what it was exactly, but it sounded like a very interesting idea, and it should be really looked at carefully. We've got Ed on Highway 1. Oh, Ed went away. Okay, well, Ed went away there. So this idea of maybe an infant account could be something that could be figured out, maybe. I don't know.
Well, it certainly would be a wonderful investment of people's $500. And Margaret is absolutely correct in her math, and also bolstering the argument that if you own your own account and you get to put money in it as a young worker, you know, in your 20s and 30s, imagine what the magic of compound interest does, never mind in 500 if an infant, but the 3% of your or the 6% of your salary as you're putting it away. And again, the most important thing is it's growing for you. Secondarily is that you own it so that when you pass away, you can leave it to your wife or your church or your dog or your kids, or if you're a small business person, invest it back into your small business at your death. And again, talking about minority communities, so many minority communities have tons of entrepreneurs. I've talked to a lot of black businessmen who are very concerned because they're worried that their business won't carry on after their death. And this would be such a wonderful way to create true wealth in minority communities. It just, I don't know, I'm baffled by why we're even having the argument about it, that it might not be a good idea. It's just stunning to me, you know. Mm-hmm, I just don't get it.
Now, I've got a question here that was put through to me by Audrey Mullen, who handles your setting up your interview. And one of the questions, interesting, it says, why is the feminist movement up in arms about Social Security? There's some shocking rationale behind their opposition to economic liberation. Do you know anything about that?
Specifically, no. Generally, yes.
Okay, what is the generally yes about why?
The feminist movement is very much aligned with either the hard left or the liberal left or the Democrats. Pick one depending on which feminist organization it is. They should be all over this. The problem is politically that nobody on the left and none of the Democrats want this to be a political success for the Republicans or the president because it makes them look bad.
It wasn't
like
their
idea,
right?
They like big government.
Yeah,
so,
it wasn't their idea. Well,
and as far as feminists go, what the heck are they thinking? You know, the example I used a little while ago about the spouse passing away, you know, you have two spouses living on two Social Security checks and one dies. Most of the time, women outlive men. Women outlive men by about 8 or 10 years now. So you have a woman who traditionally perhaps stayed at home, you know, took time out to raise a family, so obviously her Social Security check is not as high as her husband's. And Social Security, under its current fashion, is just throwing these women into poverty when the husband passes away and they lose that check. They get to pick one. You can have your husband's check or you can have your check. You can have two.
Mm.
I just find it morally egregious that they are taking this position, which I would argue harms women now, and especially with more women in the workforce. With more women in the workforce, more women today have an opportunity to accumulate real wealth through outside the home work than ever before. Why on earth would you take a position that hurts those women, that doesn't allow those women to create that wealth for themselves, to own that wealth, to see a rate of return? And as our previous caller pointed out, talking about LBJ, not allow the government to use that money. If we privatize Social Security, that money can't go into the government coffers. That money can't go to some goofy spending plan like they have in Vermont where the federal taxpayers paying to paint barns. I mean, why would you want your retirement security to pay for Vermont barns? It's crazy.
That was a Dizzy Dean idea.
It was a Dizzy Dean.
Okay, listen, we've got Ed out on Highway 1. Ed, I hope you're not living on Highway 1. You're just out there, right?
I'm just out here. When I invest money in the stock market and or in 401s or anything, I look at the administrative overhead of what that fund is costing me before I put my money in that. And what I'm kind of curious about is what is the administrative overhead of running the Social Security system, A? And B, I heard somebody talk about a council who's going to advise us on which five investment groups we're going to go into and how much that's going to cost us. I think that any time the government runs something, we end up with overheads that are unacceptable. Oh. Other than that, I have no strong feelings, and I'll just listen. Bye.
So, Carrie, how do we get, safely away from having somebody like Charles Keating doing our investing or somebody?
That's a scary thing, or John McCain. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
We wouldn't like that.
Mm-hmm.
The caller is absolutely right. I mean, any government program is going to have some overhead. Right now, the Social Security Administration is huge. And, of course, naturally over time, none of this is tomorrow. None of this happens tomorrow. All of this happens over about a 20-year period. Over time, if people are investing in their own accounts and gradually removing that amount of money from the Social Security Administration, it is going to naturally shrink. Now, because there is no such thing as government money, there's only taxpayer money used by government, that amount of money that is the burden on the taxpayer will also shrink in accordance with the shrinking of Social Security, which, of course, is another reason why Democrats don't like this very much, because they're big fans of big government and they don't want to see all these workers sort of disappear. Now, of course, some of that is going to shift over a little bit into, as the caller pointed out, into the administration of these private accounts. There's no question about that. But when you look at the amount of taxpayer money it takes to run a government system versus the amount of taxpayer money or that portion of your investment that will be run by investment managers and this finance, I'm assuming some kind of a financial board appointed by the government, it's going to be a lot less right at the beginning. And then as time goes on, it'll probably shift. The more people shift out of the government system, the better it'll be. And, yeah, there will be some cost involved. I mean, even if you, as this caller pointed out, even if you decided to invent your own Social Security and invested in IRAs and did all the kinds of things you can do as an individual, you still have cost associated with that. So, but the good news is you own the money. It does grow, and you can leave it when you go.
Now, we talked about reducing benefits. Increasing revenues. Now, we've heard about you can increase the payroll tax. Another one is raising the cap on wages subject to the tax. Another one is taxing benefits like a pension plan. I'm not sure reasonable?
No, I think that's yucky. I think any time you're adding taxes on to something tagged to retirement is bad. And I think that's basically the Republican position and the president's position. Like the last thing, if we have to tax something, the last thing we want to tax is anybody's retirement benefits. I think one of the things that seems to be on the table, which I'm not necessarily in favor of, but you have to be realistic about these things as well, is raising the cap on wages.
Mm-hmm.
I have seen some numbers that show that some of the congressmen are suggesting we raise caps on wages to the point where it would cost an average wage earner somewhere around $2,000 a year. I think that's quite a bit.
Now, there's also one other revenue idea here, including exempted federal and state workers. Who's exempted right now?
Well, that's kind of a fun question. Congress, actually.
Congress
is not.
I knew it. Oh.
Congress is not stuck in this yucky system.
Yeah, they've got a really neat system, don't they? What kind of system do they have? The one we'd like to have, right?
Yeah, that's exactly what they have. It's called the FEHBP. It doesn't really matter what it's called, but it's basically their own little privatization system. They're not stuck in the government boondoggle. They haven't been for many, many years. And this system that congressmen have, both Senate and House, is something that most of the legislation that is very popular right now is modeled on, like the Sununu-Ryan bill, which is something that a lot of those of us who work in Social Security reform like very much. And it's basically, you know, you actually are investing some of your money and you own it. The other place that's a fascinating case study to look at is down in Galveston, Texas. There was a blip in the system in 1982 where a municipality could opt out of the system. Sean Hannity talks about this all the time. I love it. I hope he talks about it more. Down in Galveston, Texas, they have a private account. They've had it since 1982. They get a guaranteed rate of return on their money, which is somewhere between 6 and 9%. It's averaged about, I think it's averaged 7.82 over the last 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
A worker who worked for 20 years making about $50,000 down there would get $3,800 a month in retirement versus $1,600 from the government. So you ask somebody, which would you rather have? Would you rather have the check for $1,500 or would you rather have the check for $3,000? And I think you get your answer pretty quick.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about just letting the, just changing the investing of the trust fund, not having a private account, just say, okay, you can now take what's in the trust fund and start investing it?
Well, first and foremost, there is no such thing as a trust fund. There's sort of like this mythical big bowl in the rotunda of the Capitol, and it says trust fund in it, and there's a note in there that says, I was here, I took your money, Uncle Sam, I owe you. There is actually not a trust fund, and every time I hear politicians talk about that, I have to kind of giggle a little bit, because as the previous caller pointed out, all the money that we pay into Social Security right now, two things. One, it all goes right back out to today's retiree. It's a pass-through. Number two, nobody has a personal account, so when you get that little thing in the mail every year that says, this is how much is in your account, it's basically a big lie perpetrated by government. And number three, whatever money is left over that doesn't get paid out goes into general revenues. And so one of the huge issues in Social Security reform, besides ownership and rate of return and growth, is three, which is use. If I put my money in the bank down the street and they offer me 3% on my money, I don't expect the government to go in there and pay for widgets out of it. And that's basically what they're doing with all the money that we are currently paying into the system. They're using it to pay for widgets, whatever kind of widgets they like the Vermont Barns or transportation, highway, whatever the heck it is. They put all that money into general revenues. So here's all these folks going to work every day, diligently, you know, paying in their 6% into the government, thinking that it goes to their retirement savings, when in reality it's not. It's going into general revenues.
Terry, we're going to go to a quick break and come back and sum this all up. You're listening to the Saturday Special. I'm Roger Pasquier, sitting in for MZ. We'll be right back.
Hi, it's MZ. You know, being in the radio business here at KSCO, I gotta tell you, there's never a dull moment. There's controversy, there's emotion, there's news, there's information. We discuss and bring to light issues, we have fun, we get silly, we get angry, but above all, we try to make a positive difference in the lives of our listeners. What I really want you to know about is one particular person who has made a truly positive difference in our lives here at KSCO. That would be Dennis, the owner and team captain of Day and Night Computer. We depend on computers for everything at KSCO. Dennis and his intimate family of high-tech professionals has made it possible for this station to grow and flourish as it never has before. Why? Because he and his crew are competent, attentive, fast, no-nonsense, and truly interested in solving your computer problems, whatever they are, right now, and without ripping you off or making your job a career. Call Dennis at 465-7340 if you want a quick and clean fix to your computer-related problem, and tell him MZ sent you. While you're at it, you'll probably make a new friend. Call Dennis at Day and Night Computer, 465-7340.
Hello, my name is Bill Lambert, and I'm the owner-operator of Lambert & Son Moving, serving Santa Cruz and Monterey counties for local and long-distance moves. Lambert & Son Moving is a local, family-owned and operated mover. Let my family take care of your family's move. Call me at 831-420-0419 for a free, no-obligation estimate. Free use of our wardrobe boxes and all packing materials for your move. Senior and student discounts, best value in town. Reliable on-time service. I personally supervise all moves from start to finish. Our clients, family, neighbors, and new neighbors will be treated with the utmost respect and courtesy. I guarantee it. Residential and commercial moves. No job too small. License insured, bonded. California PUC T number 189973. Call Bill Lambert at 831-420-0419 for all your moving needs. That's Lambert and Son Moving.
I think people want to have a conversation about money where they come away feeling stronger about their own financial possibilities to invest in the market and win. I also think that they want to have a conversation where they see clearly that they're really up to the task for stepping in and playing the market. Hi, I'm Noel Murphy. Join me for the Prosperity Hour with Donovan Lazar and Frank McHugh, investment experts, to really inspire you and educate you for what's next financially for you. That's the Prosperity Hour, Tuesdays between 1 and 2, right here on KSCO KOMY.
If I keep on the fairway, I might make par. If I keep from slicing, I might stay out of the sand trap.
If I keep sneezing, I'll never make it through 18 holes. Ugh.
Seasonal allergies can make you feel miserable. Only once-daily Allegra 180-milligram tablets have fexofenadine for long-lasting non-drowsy allergy relief, so you can feel more like yourself again. Side effects are low and may include headache, upper respiratory tract infection, and back pain. Call your doctor today about a prescription for once-daily Allegra for patients 12 and older. For more information, see our ad in Health Magazine. Call 1-800-ALLEGRA or log on to Allegra.com.
Yeah. Hey, sorry, guys. I'm just hot today.
Allegra. Enjoy your world.
And now, 20 seconds of nice. Okay, enough nice.
We're where the Central Coast comes to talk. AM 1080.
AM 1080.
KSCO, Santa Cruz.
Red Eye News Talk.
For the Central Coast.
We've been talking about the Great American Ponzi Scheme. Social Security and trying to change it into a savings scheme. Our guest has been Carrie Houston. Well, Carrie, you want to sum it up? We got a couple of minutes left anyway. Can we change this into a savings scheme?
We sure can. And, you know, I really appreciate being able to talk to folks on shows like yours, because until we really explain to the American public what this all means in very easy terms that everybody can understand without having to be like a policy geek like me, we're just not going to get anywhere. You know, my way of thinking is the role of government is twofold. One is to perform national security duties, and the other is to protect the rights of individuals. So, as I said at the beginning of this discussion, what is the basis of the discussion in Social Security reform? Is it that we must maintain a government system at all costs, no matter what, just blindly going forward saying that? Or is it to try to make sure that folks have more money in retirement? We have about 30% of America right now lives below the poverty line. That's not even talking about people who live just above it. And 68% of those folks are women. So if this system is working so great in this wonderful country that we have, why in the world do we have so many seniors living in poverty? You know, these reforms that we're talking about give people an opportunity to really see growth in their retirement savings and, again, ownership. They can leave it behind them. They can leave it to their spouse or their family. And all that hard work really is theirs. I mean, I think that despite all the financial arguments you can make about it, I think really the moral argument is the most compelling.
Carrie Houston, Vice President of Policy for Frontiers of Freedom, I really appreciate you being on the show today, and I think you've enlightened us, and certainly we haven't made any decision yet, folks. Nobody's telling you what's going to actually happen. The President, at least, has put this on the front burner, one of the front burners, and I'm glad he has done it, because I think it's something we need to take care of, and I just don't see how we're going to get around it. It's time to face this problem, even if you think it's only 47 years away. Well, it happens pretty fast. Those days go by pretty fast. So, Carrie, thank you so much for joining me.
Well, thank you, Roger. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Okay, you have a great day now.
Thank you so much. You too. Bye-bye.
Well, everybody, that wraps it up. We got to everything. With Social Security, you're on your way, and then earlier in the first hour, those difficult end-of-life decisions that everybody has to make out there. I hope you enjoyed the 2 hours of programming, and hopefully I'll be back soon again. MZ is always here, though, usually on the Saturday special. Otherwise, you have a great weekend, and we'll see you very, very, very soon. This is Roger Pasquire for the Pasquire Perspective and the Saturday special. This is KSCO Santa Cruz.
USA Radio Network News, Richard Curtis reporting. Investigators have recovered the body of 9-year-old Jessica Lunsford, who's been missing for several weeks. During a press conference this morning, Citrus County, Florida Sheriff Jeff Dozzi announced the discovery.
Somewhere between 3:30 and 4:30,